Good morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Now time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
It's a totally biased political hit job where the Democratic members are doing these closed-door meetings and then selectively leaking whatever information they want to leak out to the press.
It's trying to distract the public and the media from the fact that Ambassador Bill Taylor basically confirmed that there was a quid pro quo, and they held up funds because they wanted to start a sham investigation of a presidential candidate. That is illegal.
I have called on Paul Peterson to resign. The people's business, of course, needs to be done. What happened to Paul Peterson is a real anomaly in terms of municipal government. There likely should be a remedy in the law in which to fix a situation like this.
She was pretty blunt in her letter that she views this request as a course correction. This is how she put it, a course correction for an office that has experienced severe mismanagement and irresponsible oversight of public resources for years.
And with us to talk about Arizona GOP members, among others, of Congress crashing impeachment proceedings, Katie Hobbs' frustration with her predecessor in the Secretary of State's office, and more are Paul Bentz of High Ground and attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Guys, welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So I'm going to steal Mark Brody's line about storming the castle. It almost was like a scene from Princess Bride with some of the GOP members of Congress. So, Paul, what do you make of this as a strategy, the fact that three of Arizona's congressional members were involved?
Well, to borrow the line from Billy Crystal, have fun storming the castle. So I think this comes down to those three members of Congress are from heavy Republican-dominated districts. Gosar's is a plus 25 registration, plus 33 participation. Biggs is plus 20 and plus 26. And Lesko's plus 16 and plus 22. It's to their benefit. They win their elections in the primary, and that's who their electorate is, and that's why they're representing that.
Roy, is this as disturbing as it seems to some people? Because, yes, you can make a political game out of anything, political theater. But the fact that the institutions, many people have been concerned about that over the last 3 years because of President Trump, is that sort of in that same track?
I think it is. I mean, obviously, I think this is a silly distraction by these members of Congress, and I think it makes this what should be a very serious inquiry investigation into, you know, the president's conduct into something that's more of like a, you know, showbiz or a TV show, a reality show. I mean, the reality is when you look at what the grievances are that these Republicans say about this investigation, you realize that there's really nothing there. There's no there there. I mean, they're saying basically that Republicans have been left out of the process. Well, that's not true because all three investigative committees who have Republican members on them are allowed to sit in on these, you know, these depositions. And then secondarily, you know, if Republicans think that Democrats are not going to have public hearings related to this inquiry, then they really have been paying attention because obviously that's what's going to be coming. I already have my popcorn ready for that. And so it's very clear that you know, we're going through the first stage of an investigation, but then eventually we're going to have public hearings. That's what happened during the Watergate inquiry, and that's what's going to happen here. And by the way, the Democrats are following rules that Republicans approved when Speaker Boehner was in charge. So it's not as if we're going off of the reservation here on what and how we should conduct these investigations.
Paul, does this really come down to optics? Is this just sort of playing to the base of one of these members or some of these members' political bases here?
Well, I think both sides are playing to their base right now. They are the way the Democrats are conducting this inquiry is not the same way that it has been conducted in the past. The rules may have changed, but this is clearly to their benefit to try to cull out and do what they want with it and make their own political theater. Now, I think it was unwise for the Republicans to take their cell phones into the secure area. That's unfortunate and really does speak to the theater of all of this. But ultimately, what it comes down to is those who dislike the president and are speaking to their base that dislikes the president is taking the one side. And then, you know, in Arizona, Trump's got a 46% approval rating, but he has an 85% approval rating among Republicans. So it behooves these Republican members to defend the president.
Roy, when you look at some of the grievances that Republicans have talked about that you referenced, why not, from the Democratic perspective, why not hold a vote to sort of officially launch this? Why not have these take this testimony out in the public? Why do the things sort of, I guess, why give Republicans the ammunition to, you know, to talk about the process and try to slam the process?
Well, I mean, I think you name a couple of things there. I mean, the first thing you named was, well, why not have a vote to open the inquiry? And I think the answer to that is pretty simple, which is that it's just not required. I mean, we don't need to do that in order to start the investigation. But then, you know, the second sort of part of that is, well, why are we having these closed-door hearings? And I think that gets back to just sort of how you normally conduct an investigation, just sort of logic, right? I mean, you basically have these depositions, these witness interviews behind closed doors so that you don't allow witnesses to corroborate their stories and sort of match their stories beforehand. You usually get more honesty out of your witnesses if you're interviewing them behind closed doors. That's not something that, you know, is an unusual thing. It's not an unusual thing in law enforcement either. So I think it makes perfect logical sense for them to do it this way. And again, eventually, and Chairman Schiff has said this, that the transcripts are going to come out from these hearings. So it's not as if we're not going to know what happened behind closed doors. And then eventually, we're also going to have public hearings from some of these same people. And so Republicans are going to be able to ask questions during those public hearings, and everyone's going to see their testimony.
But Roy, then with transcripts, people actually have to read. They can't just watch the TV. That's going to be hard.
That's true. It might be only Paul and I reading.
Right, right.
Paul, let's go back a little bit to the President Trump. And I think what you said about political theater makes sense and parties playing to their bases. But how much does this indicate just how much his presence, his style, has affected how things are gone about? Obviously, whether it's President Clinton's situation or with Watergate, obviously there was behind-the-scenes drama. Some of it we then found out about, some of it we didn't. But with even just the way of political theater or House members storming a meeting, it just seems, Roy mentioned reality TV, that's President Trump's background. How much of this is his influence?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think it's the president's style. I think it's social media. I think it's the 24-hour news cycle. I think it's the perpetuation of the fact that everybody's phone has a camera on it and they can capture anything at any time, that it's pretty much all theater now. And it's all, you have to assume you're being watched and you have to react and act and react. And I think part of this is their effort to try to frame this inquiry in such a way that they can defend the president and call into question why it's even being done at the outset and try to erode the legitimacy of it. Because at stake here is the unaffiliated folks, the independents. How are they viewing this? And what do they take away from it? Because in some of these swing states, that's going to be the difference. Is do they think this inquiry is legitimate and that there's real wrongdoing here? Or do they think this is political theater and a witch hunt? And so that will be the difference in this election.
Yeah. How small a percentage of people is that, Roy, potentially?
Probably pretty small. But I think in a state like this where, you know, which I think is truly a swing state, that could make a huge difference, right? I mean, if the independents swing one way or the other on this inquiry, I think that makes a huge difference in our statewide races in particular. I totally agree with Paul. I mean, I think it really comes down to, do people see this process as legitimate? Now, I would see and I would view these actions by some of these Republicans as trying to make the process look illegitimate on purpose, right? So that at the end of the day, people don't, you know, view it that way. I think Democrats challenge, and I think so far they've done a good job, but it's certainly the challenge going forward is to make sure it looks legitimate.
Paul, how easy or difficult do you think it would be for either side to convince people to switch their minds? In other words, if there is somebody who thinks that this process is not legitimate, how hard would it be for Democrats to come up with enough evidence to convince them that maybe there was wrongdoing? And vice versa, if somebody thinks that the process is fine, how easy or difficult would it be for Republicans to convince them that A, the process isn't fine, there's nothing to see here?
I think it's an incredibly steep hill to get people to change their mind on this. It's you know, if you're with the president right now, it's very difficult to believe that this inquiry is going to somehow suddenly be the light bulb that goes off and changes your mind and say, oh, wow, I've been wrong all along, because you are coming against their cognitive dissonance, right? You're going to have to convince them that everything they've thought or trusted before now is incorrect. Similarly, I don't think you're going to have somebody who says, oh, this process is completely illegitimate and it's just such a circus and really this poor president, he's really being victimized here. I think the lines are pretty well drawn. What it comes down to is in the middle, there's a section of people who are not paying attention, that aren't really following it closely. And it's how this gets filtered and processed and presented to them in the avenues that they pay attention to that will be the difference.
Roy, would you agree with that?
I would. Now, I think we have seen some shift amongst those independents in some of the public opinion polling since this has began, right? I mean, at the beginning, before this inquiry was started, I think polling mostly showed, people in favor of this inquiry being less than the people who are not in favor of it. And I think that has shifted. I mean, I've seen, you know, CNN poll recently that not only had a majority of Americans support the inquiry itself, but also support the impeachment of the president. And that was a huge shift in that same poll. So I think we have seen some shift, but I agree with Paul. I think it's mostly coming from the independents. I think most of the partisans are staying where they usually are.
I think we've discussed this before, though. I don't think the average electorate understands what impeachment means. It's like an indictment. The conviction is done at this in the Senate, and McSally signed on with 41 other senators to the letter condemning the current process. And so what that says to the public, or at least ought to say right now, is they don't have the votes to convict. Maybe that could change depending on how that process goes. But, you know, you need at least 19 Republicans to come across the aisle and vote for conviction. There's seven short right now, with 41 Republicans signing on to a letter. They're at least seven votes short right now.
Well, that goes to what you're saying about whether the process is going to look legitimate and whether it's worth going through, even if a conviction doesn't happen. But Roy, let's follow up on the Martha McSally situation. So we've talked a lot about, I mean, the campaign, the election is still almost a year away. How does this affect what Mark Kelly's campaign may say to her? She does face primary challenges, we know, but let's say she gets through. Is this something that can be used against her? Because, again, she's been tugged back and forth. Should she be more pro-president, more not? Should she be quieter about it? How could even this, signing on to this condemnation, help or hurt her?
Well, we're a ways out, and I think we are going to go through this process, you know, where we, I mean, if you had to ask my prediction, I think the House is going to impeach him, and we are eventually going to go to the Senate, and Mitch McConnell said we're going to have a trial, and so I think that will really be where the rubber hits the road with Martha McSally and what she chooses to do once we have all the facts and the testimony occurs, and it, you know, it's a trial, essentially. I think what's disappointing about her signing on to this letter right now is that it's so premature. I mean, she's basically saying at this point that the process is a sham or unfair to the president when really we just started the process and we actually haven't seen what it's going to come up with. And so that's what I think is a disappointing sort of action by her now. But ultimately, it's going to matter what she does when this impeachment gets to the Senate.
And Paul, what do you think about that?
Well, the president endorsed her early in her primary, came out and basically also has encouraged everyone to stay out of that race. One such opponent has foolishly decided to jump in anyway. But I think he's shown that support. And also the entire victory effort in Arizona is run through Trump. It's the Trump victory effort. So if you want to have that grassroots support and that effort, there's a level of support that you are expected to offer to the president. And so I think she's playing the game well. We'll see if it makes it to the Senate and if they have the trial. I don't see a world right now where she votes to convict. I just don't see it. But we'll have to wait and see. For now, I think this was a strategic move on her part to continue to hold on to her base and ensure that that challenger doesn't have something to hang around her neck.
So is it indicative then? I mean, it kind of sounds like you think maybe it is that she's thinking more about the primary than maybe some other people are, because there's a lot of talk after she signed on that how this might hurt her with independents, with, you know, might sort of play into the same playbook that Kyrsten Sinema used to beat her last year.
Well, she suffered a pretty bruising primary last time around. I don't think she wants to go through that again. I think she'd like the president's demonstrated his support. I think they got what's in front of them is the primary, and she still has to establish that credibility. I think there's still opportunities for her to move, but she's got a very competitive general election opponent who's raising a lot of money, so she can't really afford to have to spend a lot of money in the primary right now.
That is Paul Bentz. Also here is Roy Herrera with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're in the midst of the Friday Newscap, which continues after this. It's the Friday Newscap here on KJZZ in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guests today are attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera and Paul Bentz of High Ground.
So, guys, recently we read a letter from the current Secretary of State, Katie Hobbs, asking, making her budget request, which all state agencies have to do around this time as the governor and his budget office start preparing the budget that will be released in January. This was a little bit different, though, in the sense that Secretary Hobbs had some fairly harsh words for her predecessor and the way that office was run. Roy, was that surprising at all, the way that it seemed like kind of a rebuke of Michelle Reagan's leadership of the Secretary of State's office?
Well, I don't think it was particularly surprising. I mean, for those of us who paid attention to Secretary of State Reagan's tenure during those 4 years, to find out later that she possibly may not have run the office in the most efficient and effective way possible is not particularly surprising. I think certainly the Iron Mountain revelations that came out last week
about the data storage facility.
The storage facility, you know, that maybe is a demonstration of that. you know, I think the request seemed to me to be very reasonable and responsible request. And basically, now that she's been in office, has been able to examine the office and determine sort of what's the best way to run it and how to reorganize it appropriately. And then, of course, you know, there's an increase in the budget because we're going into an election year. And we also are dealing with new threats, cybersecurity threats, for example, that also cost money to address. So I think it was a reasonable letter.
Maybe not surprising in terms of what she thinks about it. I guess I'm wondering if it's surprising that she made it so public. Like, this is something that her office sent out, this letter that was had some fairly harsh words.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, if you're going to, in order to come up with a solution, you need to identify the problem, right? And I think, you know, if she's going to do a budget request with the legislature asking for additional money and asking for changes, then she needs to justify them. And the only way I think you can really do that is by explaining what, you know, potentially happened in the past that needs to be fixed.
Yeah, there was tens of thousands of missing publicity pamphlets. We had long lines at the presidential preference election. The number of voting centers was reduced in Maricopa County with very little oversight. There's a long-awaited campaign finance website that came in way over budget and way delayed. I mean, there was a lot of things to point to during that period of time that she could point to, and I do think those are issues that need to be addressed. The one challenge she now faces, though, is she has no room for error. When you put your former predecessor on blast like that, you have to turn around and you have to run a error-free, very well-run presidential preference election early next year, and then the primary in general. Now, and also bear in mind, we move forward the primary election to August 4th. That's going to take some important conversations to remind people that it's not when they think it ought to be. She's got three elections she needs to basically nail perfectly after doing something like this.
Which we know is almost impossible.
Right,
right. Well, does it make her job marginally easier in the sense that when it comes to the presidential preference election, there's only going to be one of them. The Republicans have opted out of there. So it's just the Democrats. Presumably, if you have only one party as opposed to two, that presumably should be fewer people voting, right?
Well, but the problem is that the Democrats opted to not allow independents to vote in the presidential preference election, despite Recorder Fontes and other people encouraging them to do so. So you are still, the challenge is they're not required to allow independents to vote in that. But independents get to vote in every other election. So that confusion we saw 4 years ago is absolutely going to happen again. So that's a very steep hill to climb.
Roy, let's move on to just one aspect of the relationship there between Governor Ducey and Secretary of State Hobbs. Obviously, different parties. When Secretary of State Hobbs was in the legislature, I'm sure they didn't agree on too many things. There were a few key issues they did. Do you think that impacts at all what the Secretary is asking for? Going into an election year, as you said, it makes sense that they would work together on this. But do we see this potentially as a partisan thing, where because a Democrat's in that office, maybe won't give her the money she needs?
Well, I hope not, because I hope at the end of the day that Republicans and Democrats both agree that our elections need to be run as smoothly as possible. And if that, you know, if the budget request is including items that are completely necessary to make that happen, which I assume it is, then I think, you know, Governor Ducey would agree with that. And I think that's what part of this process is now. You know, the request has been made, and then I think we go into the next session, the Secretary of State is going to make the case for why she needs these things that she needs. And again, you know, inevitably that involves, you know, critiquing maybe what the office was when you got there. But I think that's what she's going to do. And I'm hopeful that the Republicans in the legislature, at least in principle, will agree that we need to, you know, run things as efficiently and effectively as possible for our voters.
Well, Paul, even if some people were critical of this, we've certainly seen that at the Maricopa County level, where you mentioned Recorder Fontes. He and Supervisor Chair Bill Gates have been getting along on that issue and figuring out a way to make sure elections run as smoothly as possible. Is that possible at the state level?
I think everybody wants the elections to move smoothly, and I think the cybersecurity needs are real. I think when you look at long-term technological needs and the way things are changing and the people have proven their ability to hack various items, the security of our elections is absolutely paramount, and I think that they'll come to agreement on that. The bigger challenge will be the more political nature of the staffing piece of this and who's getting hired and for what jobs. I think that will be the place where we'll probably see some more politics and people go to their sides and decide how that's going to be played.
Hopefully, we won't see any Russian bots.
Hopefully.
Yeah, right. So, another big issue that has sort of enveloped at least Maricopa County and has been seemingly for a few weeks now is the case of County Assessor Paul Peterson. He has not resigned. He has said he is not going to resign. The County Board of Supervisors seems poised early next week to suspend him for a few months. There's been talk of putting into place some kind of mechanism for somebody like that to be removed from office if there's an indictment or maybe a conviction? Roy, it seems like it's kind of a slippery slope there, right? Like, and there's been some criticism of a bill that was proposed about, you know, giving officials the authority to remove somebody over an indictment. There seem like there might be some due process concerns there, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is a slippery slope. I mean, on the one hand, I mean, you know, we have a criminal justice system where you are, you know, innocent until proven guilty, right? And so if you're indicted, that doesn't mean that you've actually convicted, you know, or you've actually done those crimes. And so if you have the ability to remove somebody on that basis, then perhaps there's a concern there. And then also there's the concern, and I think this has been stated by Mr. Peterson's defense lawyer, that, you know, he was duly elected by voters in Maricopa County, and so just taking him away before he's been convicted is just not fair to that process either. On the other hand, though, of course, the allegations seem to be pretty egregious, and you know he's under investigation with multiple jurisdictions right now. I know his new defense lawyer. I think he's a very good defense lawyer. I was across the aisle from him when I was a prosecutor myself, and I'm sure he's going to do a good job for him. But at the end of the day, it looks pretty bad in what he's facing. And so, you know, knowing that, do we want that kind of person as our assessor? I don't know. I'm not sure we do, right? But I guess, you know, over time, we'll see what happens.
Paul, is there a balance to be struck here in terms of, obviously, Paul Peterson is not doing his job right now. He's not in the state. He's under indictment, you know, trying to fight that. At the same time, though, as Roy said, he is an elected official, as elected as anybody else on the county level. So is there a balance to make sure that the people's business, as the governor likes to say, continues to get done while making sure that, you know, somebody isn't removed from office maybe prematurely?
Well, it's going to be very difficult for him to do his job from a prison cell. So I think that neglect of duty and then suspending him for 120 days is a piece of this. They're also doing an audit of his office right now to see if he was using public resources for his private sector job. They said they found a lot of files on his computer, other things related to his private job. I think that's an issue of concern as well. So I think this is ongoing, and I'm not necessarily sure the legislation is going to be the last piece we see dealing with this issue. I think there might be multiple pieces that try to approach this from different ways. One of the challenges is that this office, each county, their assessor, their sheriff, their attorney, their treasurer and superintendent of schools, and the clerk are all in the Arizona Constitution. So we have a challenge here, and they're much more important or bigger roles in some of our rural counties than necessarily they are in Maricopa County. But it's not a quick fix. You know, they are constitutional offices. This might be an opportunity to review what offices ought to be or not ought to be elected, but that will be a longer, more arduous process than we can deal with right now.
That's a debate that often comes up even at the state level with the Corporation Commission. Should we get more people who are actually trained for it, or does it end up being political cronyism to some extent? One very, very serious question. Mark and I were talking about this beforehand, that on Twitter it appears Rodney Glassman wants to run for that position. Is anyone surprised?
No.
Not in the slightest, and I will reserve all comment about that after that.
Roy, let me ask you one thing about moving forward. We know that Arizona Democrats would like to have a Democratic debate hosted here in Phoenix. When I spoke months ago to Tom Perez, the indication was that a city like Phoenix in the Southwest would make sense. How important do you think that would be overall for addressing certain issues here, or at least, again, getting Phoenix back on the map for this sort of event?
I think it would be very important. I mean, I think it would signify national Democrats taking Arizona seriously as a battleground state in the presidential, which I think it is, and it's become now. And I think having a debate here would signify that. And I think it would be helpful, too, if we had a debate here where we talk about issues that are very important to Arizonans. Sometimes that's different than what's being talked about in Iowa, for example. So I think having it here is very important. And then, of course, I do think this is going to be perhaps a close primary. I don't think there's going to be somebody who's just going to run away with it. And so for the first time in a long time, our primary, which happens kind of late in the game, might actually matter when it comes to, you know, hunting for delegates. And so having it here, I think, would be great.
Well, Paul, even the fact that Nevada has moved up the date of its, I guess, the caucus in their case, how much does that help even if there were a debate in the Phoenix area, issues that, you know, we saw what happened during the Great Recession with housing, for example, and how both areas were affected.
I think the Southwest Valley or the Southwest region is incredibly important in this election. And I heard he say it's a battleground state. I think it's a must-win state for Democrats. And, you know, we had a presidential debate in Mesa in 2012, and it was incredibly successful. And I think we've proven the ability to host a debate, and I think that it's a good goal to go after. I think the challenge – and we're growing by – we have – more than 675,000 new voters in the last 10 years. We're growing more Democratic and more younger, particularly in our metro areas. So it's a key demographic that those folks want to appeal to. The challenge will come down to how are the issues debated. Immigration is still a very top issue in the state of Arizona. Depending on how they address that issue, and if it's a run to the left and they all try to compete and are able and suddenly get cast as open borders advocates, that's going to hurt. It could hurt some of these candidates to address these issues if they're still trying to vie for the Democratic nomination and not understanding the Arizona electorate.
Roy, on a practical level, does it help Democrats to have a primary here in terms of maybe getting people to go to it and being able to, you know, register them to vote or register them with the party? I mean, you both talked about sort of the symbolic value of having that. But on a more practical level, is there value to Democrats as well?
I think it does. I mean, I've always been a believer that having a competitive primary is a good thing in the long run for a particular party because it just gets people activated and interested earlier on than they normally would. And so I think if we do have a presidential primary that is competitive and important, such that turnout is higher and engagement is higher, that is a good thing going into November because that just means people are starting to think about these things earlier. So if we have that here, I think that's a good thing.
I 100% agree. Competitive primaries is one of the biggest things that helped Democrats in 2018. They had more competitive primaries last year than they had ever had, and it really helped increase attention and turnout, and that repped huge benefits in the general election.
Roy, what's the ideal number of Democratic candidates at that point, whenever that debate would be in Arizona? How many would you actually like to see on stage?
Well, certainly somewhere between 20 and 2, I think. Because I do think we've had too many on the stage. And, the problem, of course, is that you have some people that are, you know, candidates and are taking up debate time and airtime that really have no realistic shot at being the nominee. That being said, I mean, I still think that there's probably 5 or 6 candidates that have a shot. Certainly, there's probably a top 3, but then after that, there's another sort of tier. So if they're all involved, again, I think that's a good thing. I don't want this to necessarily lead to a brokered convention or something like that, because then a good thing turns into a bad thing. But I think, again, having something that's competitive is always good, because I think at the end of the day, all the Democrats, all the candidates, all the respective campaigns are going to come together to try to defeat Donald Trump.
Guys, in the last 45 seconds or so, very serious topic we have to discuss. Suns got off to a 1-0 start, and now starting center DeAndre Ayton has been suspended. So are they going to go 1-25? What do you guys think?
Boy, as a U of A grad, I was definitely disappointed to see the hometown hero. But I have to say, after the win, I sort of was waiting for the other shoe to drop, and it only took 23 hours for it to happen.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm a lifelong Suns fan. I cried when they lost the 93 finals. It's just been a life of heartbreak for me. So the moment that I got excited after when we were up by 18, I was like, this will last for a few hours, and that's exactly what happened.
You should have known better at this point.
I should have known better. I shouldn't have got my hopes up.
In 93, I had Suns shaved inside of my head. So I was
are there
the
photos of this?
No, there are not, fortunately.
As Mark can attest, I've learned to hold my feelings inside, but they were starting to seep out there as well. Roy Herrera, former congressional staffer and attorney. Paul Bentz of High Ground. Guys, thanks as always.
Thank you very much.